This is Nullius in Verba, a podcast about science.
What it is, and what it could be. It's co-hosted by me, Smriti Mehta from UC Berkeley.
And me, Daniel Lagens from Eindhoven University of Technology.
In this episode, we discuss the importance of theoretical and conceptual development in psychological research. We talk about defining concepts clearly, mapping relationships between concepts before testing hypotheses, and ask why we don't teach theory building the way we teach methods. Enjoy.
Okay, Daniel. So I have a theory, and my theory is that when people use the term theory, they all mean slightly different things. Well, not all of them, but oftentimes when people use the term theory, they're using it to mean very different things.
Could very well be. Okay.
And I'm wondering if we can sort of lay out, before we start talking about theories, the different ways in which people use the term theory. I just started with using the term theory. In which sense did I mean that?
I think in terms of a scientific theory, which I think people define as the way they heard it the first time in some sort of introduction course decades ago, which is something like a scientific set of statements that together create a model or something like this.
That's not how I used it when I started. So what you're describing is one way in which theory is used, which maybe we can maybe think about as the formal scientific use of the theory. But we use it in everyday language in the way I did when I started. And that, I think, is what people mean by just a hypothesis or prediction. Would you agree?
Yeah, I
like
think
here's
so.
Here's my theory, right? Like, here's what I hypothesize is going on.
I like it. It reminds me of a comment that a physics student once made after a lecture I taught about psychology. So because we're at a big technical university, we used to teach a course for anybody about psychology, sort of very general introduction course. And there were physics students in there. And then, of course, you had to talk about introduction to psychology topics such as cognitive dissonance theory.
Classic.
And this student came walking up to me after a lecture and spoke words that now linger in my mind forever. And he said, "Whenever you say theory, I don't think that means what I think it means, you know?" And then I had to say, well, you're right. Yeah, when I talk about theory, I mean like psychologists talk about theory, which is pretty much like just a hunch.
Yeah, just a hunch. Exactly.
But for him, a theory is, of course, a very developed formal model, you know, in physics, right?
Yes, yes. And that's one of the way I think that comes to my mind of like the different ways in people use theory. So, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but there's certainly theory when we are talking about, oh, I have like a hunch of what's going on, some prediction. It could even be a set of, you know, sort of ideas that you think about what's going on. But yeah, maybe in the way this physics student, that's a great anecdote, is talking about, is in physics you would have, once you've done all the empirical work and you're right, then you are developing a set of laws. And that's what they would call a theory, right? These are the laws that govern, right? The state of the universe, whatever, whatever, you know, meager things they do
everything.
Over there.
Yeah. The theory of everything.
Exactly, right? The set of laws that govern. And I think that's the way I think what theory gets used at the end of of a research, you know, at a line of research, which is different from, I think, when we talk about starting from theory when doing research. So it's interesting that we use sort of, can you think of other ways in which theory gets used?
Well, there's also people who talk about theory and then they talk about mid-level theory. And that's also interesting. So you have like a high level and a mid level.
Yeah, high level theories. I think that, you know, macro theories, which would be something like self-determination theory, right? Like a really broad framework of a bunch of little theories. So you have, a macro theory, high level theory, mid theory. And then I think people do make a distinction of like micro theories, which would just be individual predictions that are derived from the sort of mid-level theories. So
I've actually only heard the term mid-level theory, but I think that logically implies there have to be smaller versions.
Yeah, exactly.
and larger versions.
Yeah.
I guess. But nobody's ever talked like, but this is a high-level theory and this is a micro-level theory. But yeah, you're right.
Right.
They must exist.
Yeah. So for example, to sort of carry on that example, right, you would have self-determination theory as your sort of macro high-level theory. And then let's say you have the theory of, you know, autonomy or competence would be your mid-level, versions of one of the theories that fall within it. And any prediction you're deriving from, autonomy is related to a sense of belonging or something like that. That would be sort of a...
Yeah. I'm just going to Wikipedia like a real researcher. But it says middle range theory developed by Robert K. Merton, so that's interesting, is an approach to sociological theorizing aimed at integrating theory and empirical research. It is currently the de facto dominant approach to sociological theory construction.
Hmm. By sociological, do they mean in sociology?
Yeah.
Okay.
This approach stands in contrast to earlier grand theorizing of social psychology, such as functionalism and conflict theories.
Yeah. High-level grand theories. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Raymond Boudon has argued that middle-range theory is the same concept that most sciences simply call theory.
Yeah, exactly. So there's these different levels of theories, and people use it in different ways, and we want to be clear about which theories we're talking about, because the topic today is theory building. And
you should say that. Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Daniel. We mean, when we say theory building, I'm actually curious what you think. I think we mean mid-level theories, but maybe we mean both the laws that are derived at the end of, it's an ongoing process, but something that we, the laws of like how things work, explanations of the natural world, but also theory in the sense of what you're starting out with, some idea about what is the phenomenon or different variables that you're interested in and how do they relate to each other? Yes?
Yeah, I think maybe actually primarily the first. So I would say a theory you can actually use as an empirical scientist.
Interesting.
And I think that what we'll talk about mainly is a nice book by Dubin from 1969, Theory Building.
Yeah.
But he also explicitly states in the introduction, actually, that he wrote this book a little bit out of frustration for the fact that there is this big divide between theorists and empiricists.
Interesting.
And the people who are doing theory are all high and lofty about theory, and the empiricists are all about, no, but you just need empirical data. And he's like, let's try to bridge the two. But he's really saying that there's a lack of practical guidance for researchers to bridge this. So this is how to build a theory that really bridges the empirical domain and the theoretical domain so that, as an empirical researcher, you have a theory that you can use to guide your tests and that you can develop over time and that can eventually help you to make better predictions.
Yeah, great. And I do think, I haven't read the whole book, but I did read a very nice chapter that summarizes the book. And they do mention that his method, that it's written for applied scientists, applied researchers. Do you think that's true? Do you think there's any use in this for people who are not applied researchers? Whatever that means.
It's very interesting. So there are a couple of other books about theory building that I know and some that I actually use in teaching, for example. But it's interesting that this book, for example, has no section on creativity. You know, it has no section where it says, here are all sorts of kind of tricks you can use to come up with creative thoughts that might inspire a theory. It's really very strongly empirically driven throughout. And there are definitely other approaches to theory building, maybe that lead to this slightly higher level theory building, mm-hmm. where you have all sorts of practical exercises, such as learn about some sort of theory in a completely different discipline, and by analogy, try to translate this to some sort of psychological process. Mm. And then you're like, okay, well, you know, that we have a theory about how water boils, and boiling happens, and there's pressure building up, but there's also pressure building up in people. Maybe it would be the same. You know, this kind of theorizing.
Interesting.
And that's not Dubin's thing. Right. That's not his thing. Uh-huh. He's really the empiricist, sort of, you know, very strongly tied to this. So you could read other books about theory building, and it would give you kind of another approach.
Yeah.
But this is really for... It's really detailing all the necessary steps. Mm-hmm. If you want to go out and do empirical science, how can you do this with a theory?
Right. Very nice. So before we go into and discussing the method, and it is a very nicely laid out, like there's, you know, two parts, there's eight steps. Mm-hmm. So very practical, mm-hmm. like you say, and I think very useful to go through. So there's these two parts. One is theory development, and the second mm-hmm. is research operation. So sort of first, you actually, without really collecting empirical data, you are just developing the theory. You're sort of mapping mm-hmm. out the landscape, mm-hmm. you are thinking about how the connections are. And then once mm-hmm. you have that, then you start the process of actually testing it empirically. So I will just mention first the two parts and the eight steps, mm-hmm. and then we can discuss them mm-hmm. at length. So the first is units. So this is in mm-hmm. the conceptual framework. Like, what are the things out of which the theory is built? Mm-hmm. And as we do it, I actually thought it would be useful for us to think about what are the other terms that get used in the discipline for these same things? Because they do get talked about, maybe just not in the same words. Mm-hmm. So what do you think people, like when they say, when you say units, what mm-hmm. do you think, how else do you think it's described when we talk about research?
Well, one way that Dubin himself talks about it as uh-huh. well is concepts. He says it's basically sort of the same as uh-huh. concepts, except that is a bit of a vague term used for too many things, he thinks. So he basically replaces it with units. Which he feels is a bit more neutral.
Right.
But so the stuff that goes in the theory, I guess.
Constructs is another one.
Oh, yeah.
Variables, maybe. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. All of those terms, I think, are in some ways slightly interchangeable. Okay, so that's mm-hmm. units. Then we have laws of interaction. And that's the mm-hmm. manner in which the units of the theory interact.
Yeah. The relationships,
the associations, exactly. Mm-hmm. Third, mm-hmm. we have the boundaries. And these mm-hmm. are, what are the real world limits of the theory? And those actually we do just kind of call boundary conditions, right?
We call them boundary conditions. My theories, of course, are universal, apply to everything, everywhere. You know, it's relevant for everything in the world and the universe, but sometimes...
But what about other universes, Daniel?
They go across multiverses.
All the multiverses. No, of course.
Mm. All theories have limitations, and I think this is a very interesting aspect of the preparation of making a theory that I rarely see happen. Yeah. We'll discuss it in more detail.
Then we have system states, which was kind of an interesting one and a little bit harder for me to wrap my head around. But this is the conditions under which the theory is operative. And I'm not, and maybe we can talk about it later, but like the distinction between boundaries and system states is sort mm-hmm. of vague for me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's the vaguest.
It is the vaguest. I agree. Yeah, yeah. And then, so those are the first steps for theory development. This is mostly conceptual mm-hmm. work. And then we mm-hmm, go into mm-hmm. the research operation. We first start out with propositions, which are truth statements about the theory. So these are not like truth statements about the world, but actually truth statements about the theory. And this is, I find it the mm-hmm. most, like, very interesting. It's just like sort of logical mm-hmm. Statements about what is true within and coherent within the theory.
Yeah, really the kind of if then that.
Right. Yeah.
And it's nice that you say, like, yeah, I find this the most interesting part, because I'll just give you a quote from Dubin in his book. Uh-huh. He says, "Indeed, it is at this point that theory building becomes exciting and thoroughly interesting. The design of a model is, of course, an exacting task. Uh-huh. However, to put the model to work, to see what it can do in operation, is the feature of theorizing that makes the game more than worth the effort." he's basically saying, yeah, half of my book you have to go through because that's the boring part, but here it starts to get exciting.
Fun. Yeah.
Which I think is also interesting to talk about, because we don't see people do the first part that much. We see them do this part. They jump into this part. So I think you're completely right. Here it gets exciting.
Right.
This is all what we like.
But I will probably argue that it is only going to be this exciting once you've done the legwork before.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like there's something very neat about having, you know, laying all your chips on the table and then actually seeing how they fit together, right? That's what's exciting about it, right? But if you haven't done the work of actually laying out how, you know, all the puzzle pieces, well, that's not fun to figure out like how the pieces are going to fit together, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're not sure all the pieces are there. That analogy is a little strained. Okay. Number six, empirical indicators of key terms. So these are like empirical indicators that produce values on the units, values for the units. And this, tell me, to correct me if you think I'm wrong, but this I think is what we would call operationalization.
Totally.
Like, right, you have your constructs. How are you going to get numbers on them? You have to operationalize it some way, the empirical indicators.
I agree.
Yeah.
And measurement, right?
Aha.
Measuring stuff.
Interesting.
This is your ball game. I mean, this is measurement.
Mm-hmm.
So operationalizing and measuring, this is the moment where your theory is going to be expressed in real world things.
Right.
So before you can just stay abstract sort of, but now you have to say, no, but what is it going to be? What I'm going to measure? So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very good. And then we have number seven is hypotheses, which are predictions about the values of the units of a theory. So now you've... figured out what your units are. How are you going to, how do they relate to each other? How do you get empirical indicators of them? And then what are your predictions about the different values of all the units in the theory, all the constructs? We also just call them hypotheses, right? There's no special term for it. And the final number eight is just testing. Then you actually go out and test your hypotheses and see if they align with your predictions.
Exactly. And I think it might be safe to say that many times people just jump to step seven. You just come up with a hypothesis and then they go and test it. And I think this book is trying to convince people of the importance of going through all these earlier steps so that you can have a meaningful hypothesis and a test.
Yeah.
He will say somewhere, like, you know, if you want to start fiddling around, he mentions this, fiddling around, go into step seven, and then backtrace basically all the way to step one.
Mm.
He says that can be useful, can be done. But the book is written sort of like, you know, in the opposite direction. I mean, you start... You know, you can do the other thing, he says, might be useful, but yeah. So maybe before we go into these steps, do you think it's important that we learn more about this? Because do you feel there's room for improvement in theorizing?
I mean, you are asking that as a rhetorical question.
No, I'm trying, you know, you criticized me in a previous episode about asking directional questions. I'm trying, really trying here to be more, okay, but you
this
got
is
me,
not a
you
very,
got
yeah.
me. I failed.
You're
I
not
failed.
Doing
it
a very
was a
good
bit,
job.
All right. So people have been complaining about the state of theorizing in psychology and for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you some old quotes that, you know, I have this paper about previous crisis in psychology, and I discussed this. This was also a theory crisis, but then in the 70s. Let's start with Elms, who says, social psychology is clearly in need of new and better theories, probably the most persistent complaint in the field's history from within and without is that it is largely empirical with little theoretical guidance.
Mm.
It's true. Maybe a favorite of Paul Mill. He says, it is simply a sad fact that in soft psychology, theories rise and decline, come and go, more as a function of baffled boredom than anything else.
Right.
And the enterprise shows a disturbing absence of that cumulative character that is so impressive in disciplines like astronomy, molecular biology, and genetics.
Yeah.
So we are not like those fields. We're not doing a good job theorizing.
No, we're not. And I think, and I mean, you're saying, can we do better? Yeah. And I think something like going through this process, I mean, even just reading this summary paper, the summary chapter, I thought was just so useful in something I could have really, you know, benefited from if I'd been exposed to it early on in my graduate career, right? Before you actually go out and start doing things the way, like you're saying, right? You just have a hunch and you're just now going to test it, to actually sit down and first map the nominological network. We forgot that one, Daniel. I think that would go with the laws of interaction, right? Like, hey, what are the things I'm interested in? What are all the relevant variables in this space? How do they relate to each other, right? What does that mean? How will I go and test them? And I think, yeah, it's, what's tricky is that I think once in psychology, people do come up with theories, I think they popularize them prematurely. And there's a lot of, you know, putting your name on things and then, oh, this is this person's theory, this is that person's theory, sort of like the toothbrush issue that we talked about. And they're not, I think, they're no longer treated as these, you know, these systems of, you know, related concepts and associations that describe something real about the world. They just become people's properties.
Yeah.
Right? Like researchers have ownership over them. And I think pollutes the whole game a little bit, right? Because then theory building is almost, right? I think that's why a lot of people in this sort of, after the sort of replication crisis and stuff, are really moving away from this idea of actually building coherent and foundational theories, and a lot of just focusing on effects and just collecting empirical data and being really rigorous in that, which has benefits, right? But I think the end result should be thinking more deeply about, well, what does that mean, and going up a level. So I think,
yeah,
it's definitely an issue, and I think it's an issue we should try to address early on in researchers' career.
And interestingly, you mentioned like it's so useful to read this just this summary chapter. We'll link to it. I mean, or the whole book. I can highly recommend it. But the interesting thing is that many books about theory that try to educate people about theory, for example, there's Svetberg, The Art of Social Theory. I mean, there we'll mention some other ones maybe. But all of them very early on say nobody teaches theory. You know, we don't really teach it. So I wanted to write a book about it, or I wanted to write a paper about it, because, this seems to be something that we don't really explicitly teach.
No.
And I have to say that I didn't, you know.
Yeah.
We just sort of think, we say, come up with a hypothesis. And then if people would ask, where does this hypothesis come from? We don't really have a very good answer. Yeah. So it's interesting. And this Svetberg book that I mentioned, this is from 2014, he also makes an interesting point about this. I'll just read the opening passage. An important reason for devoting a book to the topic of theorizing is that theory is currently not in a very good shape in social science. One way to quickly get a sense for why this is the case is to compare the state of theory to that of methods. And I have found this interesting myself, so I'll go on. Since World War II, methods have advanced very quickly. For many years, students have also been able to take courses that give them a solid foundation in methods. And this goes for quantitative as well as qualitative methods. Nothing similar is available in theory or theorizing. More generally, social theory is currently not very innovative and has little to say on many important issues. But this point that there's nothing similar in theory or theorizing, it's not, you're not getting a whole course on theorizing. You're getting multiple courses, I think, in many, many bachelors and masters on methods. But not a single course, not half a course on theorizing. And I think that is really an interesting observation, and it is a real lack.
Absolutely. So now that we've established, yes, theory building, we should definitely focus on. And there's recently also been a lot of calls for, oh, we're in a crisis and we should have more computational theory building and all of this stuff that is above my head. But I kind of wanted to juxtapose these steps with, so Ben Wright, who's, big proponent of, was a big proponent of IRT, item response modeling. He, in a presentation, I think he sort of talks about it in multiple places, but at some point during a talk at the College of Education, University of Denver, he was talking about the process of science. And it was very interesting. He laid out five steps, and it would be interesting to see how they tie in with, and it's interesting that you mentioned that empirical indicators of key terms ties with measurement. So he says, okay, so in science, the way you do science is first you have exposure, and this is where you're simply exposed to something. You
observe.
Well, the second step is observation. Exposure is not the same thing as observation, which is very true, even if you think about your sensory system, or you think about even research, right? You might be exposed to some, right? Anything, but you're making observations, which are sort of more narrow and focused. And he makes the distinction between observation and measurement, because they're not the same. So you have some observations, but then you actually have to turn them into numerical categories. That's measurement, and that's different. And then you go into analysis, and he makes a distinction of measurement is always unidimensional, right? You always measure a single thing. So it's always unidimensional. And analysis is always multivariate or multidimensional, in that you're looking at the relationships between two things or three things or however many things. And then the fifth step is the theory. Which I thought was kind of an interesting way to put it. Now, the units, when we're talking about the units, so you mentioned, okay, the empirical indicator of the key terms, that's where the measurement comes in. But what I sometimes struggle with is when you're talking about the units, right, and the constructs, especially when you're doing measurement, you realize that, well, A, you need a theory to properly define, right, even the units of measurement. And that without, and that sometimes it is in the process of measuring the thing that you actually are able to refine what you mean by that thing. Right. Yeah.
So also the conceptualization.
Exactly.
Is sort of, you know, and the measurement. I had a conversation with a philosopher of science working in the department next to mine, basically, or the group next to mine, philosophy and ethics, and at my university, a collaborator, and he was working on a book, and he wanted to summarize basically all these processes, you know, all these processes that we do as scientists, because he wanted to point something out about all of them, but he wanted to put them in a figure, and he was, you know, trying to put arrows between them and make it sort of structured. And I also thought about this. It's not like, we always teach you like step one, step two, step three, but it's really like a hugely integrated mess with arrows going all over the place between all these things, right? So I think for educational purposes, we sort of try to separate them. But I think in practice, I mean, there's
just loops everywhere.
Because you start with some sort of vague theory and then come up with a concept, and then you try to measure it and you change your concept, and then you actually have to think, wait, so my theory is actually more about this, so not about this. And then, anyway, it goes all over the place, back and forth, like a ping pong ball. But that's difficult to teach.
that is difficult to teach and difficult to make lists with.
So let's say this is a very structured but also abstract overview of these different steps. I think so. Nevertheless, so we can start at the beginning somewhere. And that's, the goal, of course, to build theories, that's the beginning, actually, right? So you have to think, why am I actually building this theory? What do I want to do with it? And very often, the goal of building a theory, there are two goals that somebody like Dubin talks about. And the first is understanding, building a model that helps us understand things. And the second is building a model that can help us predict things. So these are two goals that we can do if we have a theory. And those are difficult to do without a theory, is the point. Interestingly, you can do both of them independently. You would think, but if you understand something, you can predict it, which is also sometimes the case, but they can also be separate. So we can build models that can predict very well, but we don't really know why. And we can build models where we build a solid understanding, but they don't really have good predictive power, but we understand stuffs, but, you know, we understand tiny little things about it, but they can't really lead to good predictions.
They don't have a lot of predictive power.
But those are two goals of theory building. That's why we want them. Yeah.
Do you think one has higher priority than the other?
It's a very interesting question. I definitely know that psychologists, like in our field, completely prefer understanding over prediction.
Right.
Whereas a field like computer science almost explicitly says, yeah, mm-hmm. we're building these models. We don't really understand what these models do. They do all sorts of deep learning stuff. And, you know, now, especially with AI, AI can predict pretty well, but there's a whole field of explainable AI, like what is actually doing, you know? Yeah. So they don't understand why it's predicting well. If you build a model, you don't know why. So, so those are differences between disciplines, really big differences. And I think there have been some arguments. There's a paper by Tal Yarkoni and Jake Westfall that we should actually embrace more prediction than understanding. I don't know. I'm not sure. But I think as with anything where there's a big culture in one direction, people probably forget to ask, wait, but what's my goal here actually? Maybe my goal is this other thing that I want to do a bit more. So I don't know. But
I have an opinion on this. I mean, I could be wrong, but I think it's fine to be married to prediction and say, hey, that's what we're going to focus on. And I think that's fine. But then I don't think you can claim that you're doing science.
You're just dismissing, like, this is the new demarcation criteria by Smriti, computer science.
Goal
you're not doing science.
Your job is not to simply predict, but to explain and understand. I think Richard Feynman has a nice quote on it. It's like the Mayan calendar could predict to a very great accuracy, right? The lunar eclipses or whatever, right? The phases of the moon. It doesn't mean that they understood what the moon was, right? Or why it, you know, why it, you know, acts the way it does and why we have, you know, lunar eclipses and all these things, right? So you can have systems where you are really good at predicting things and not be able to understand at all what's going on. That's not, I think, what science is meant to do. I'm not saying that's not part of it. That is certainly a part of it, right? I mean, there's so many things where you have a theory, you make a prediction based on your theory, and once that prediction is confirmed, then you know that the theory is correct. But it's the theory that helps you explain things, right? Yeah. It's the goal is not just to make predictions; it's to make predictions that verify a theory. Yeah,
and that is based on some understanding that you've built. You'd say understanding is crucial,
right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think I'm not sure if it's just that this is how I've been brought up in my own discipline, but I feel sort of the same. But I mean, there are big differences. Another thing that we do in science also that Dubin briefly describes is description. And he also says description is not the same as research. He actually says, you know, sometimes we just describe things. It's also an essential process in science to do this. But he says, we have description and we have research, and they're both part of scientific activities, but they're not the same. And only, this explanation and prediction, those things, those are research. Ooh. I found that also interesting.
Well, I might say maybe here we would want to draw a distinction between research and scientific research. If you're saying, hey, this is not scientific research, maybe I agree. But I mean, if you're a journalist and you're describing some events, I mean, that is still research, right? Or if you're a historian, that is also research. It could just be description, but it's still research, but not, again, not the way I was saying it's not science.
Yeah, but he really distinguishes collecting variables for their own sake. So let's say a journalist wants to know how many robberies happen in this area, you know, and that's just, you know, the number, that's the end goal. And he says, they shouldn't be collected for their own sake, because it's only research when they are part of measured units that are explicitly part in some sort of theory, then they become part of research. So if you just describe things and it's outside of the context of a theory where you've specified your units, then they're separate from this research process. I don't know. I don't know if it matters too much. Maybe it's just analytical distinction. But I thought it was interesting. Mm-hmm. It's opinionated in any case. Let's put it like this.
So are we, which is fun. Yeah. Okay.
So this first step are these units, right? The first thing, and he mentions them, they're concepts, they're the stuff that goes into your theory. I mean, sometimes these units can be variables, as you already mentioned, and then we often think about our dependent variables, of course.
Yeah.
He also uses the term attributes, And attributes are more things that you have or not have. So these are things that we would typically see as the independent variable. Mm-hmm. And a certain condition, another right. condition, you know, mm-hmm. that has one attribute or it lacks one attribute. Mm-hmm. And then we study the differences. But yeah, these are the concepts. And I found this, this is, I think, a very interesting step, actually.
The units?
Of defining, mm-hmm. yes, the units, but not just the units, but the fact that you have to do this process of conceptualizing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What is it that you're talking about?
Right.
What are the things in your theory? And he doesn't just say, put a name on them, choose yeah. a name and uh-huh. use the name. But he says, no, define your concepts.
Right.
He even uses the, I think somewhere, necessary and sufficient. I mean, he's really talking basically about get the philosopher friend over.
Yeah.
And what I found interesting in this is mm-hmm. that very recently, so I already mentioned this philosopher we're working with. Mm-hmm. He's a colleague, Chris Tfase. He mm-hmm. works in the philosophy department. And he's involved in a project that we've just started 2 months ago. This is a project on coordination in science mm-hmm. With a new PhD student who started on this, Said Rusty. And so we're trying to wrap our head around this concept of coordination.
Hmm.
And what's interesting, I think, is that Chris brought up this term, conceptual engineering.
Hmm.
And I've never heard this, but this is apparently a big deal in... in okay. philosophy.
Huh.
I mean, there's a paper on it, on conceptual engineering by Isaac Koch and Neft from mm-hmm. 2022. And they write, the recent excitement over conceptual engineering has been fermented by a number of factors. You know, you didn't know this, huh? Recent excitement about conceptual. You missed it, Shmiti.
Yeah, I did. I'm out of the loop.
So I never heard about this as well, but it's really interesting. It's mm-hmm. a really interesting approach.
Yeah.
And I really think we could use a little bit more of this in our field because I'm often so frustrated by bad conceptual definitions or
yeah.
basically the absence of any definition.
Right. Yeah. And it's even worse in our field because oftentimes the words and labels people use are things that everybody uses in everyday
yeah.
language as well, which makes it even more mm-hmm. confusing of like not defining things properly, I think makes it even more problematic. So I really like, yeah, I think when he talks about units, he does mention, I mean, all these really, I think, helpful things about thinking through is it a unit or an event? Mm-hmm. Is it an attribute or a variable? Mm-hmm. Is it a real mm-hmm. versus nominal? I'm not even sure I understand that. Primitive versus sophisticated, collective or versus a member. And just useful of just like category, like giving you some tools to think how to think about these units, like which mm-hmm. which category do they fall in and how what can you do with these units once you've established, you know, what quadrant they're in.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's definitely an important step. And I really think that this idea of conceptual engineering, and I'm completely a novice to it, so mm-hmm. I'm just reading about all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But I really think it's something that we could do a little bit more because if you define something, I think what we often think about as scientists is we have to make a definition that is very close to the truth. Right? Our definition needs to express maybe what this thing is in reality mm-hmm. or something. So that's very a descriptive process. We're
yeah.
trying to really accurately describe it.
Mm-hmm.
But in conceptual engineering, you're basically saying, no, I am creating a definition that has a certain function. I'm trying to have a definition that will allow me to do something. I'll give you an example.
So that's like a utilitarian approach.
Yeah, a very functional,
yeah.
at least a very functional, mm-hmm. yeah, very functional approach. And I'll give you an example that you might remember because the International Astronomical Union
mm-hmm.
came up with a new definition of what a planet
oh, yeah.
was.
After Pluto. Was demoted.
Exactly. It did.
Yeah.
It did not end well for Pluto, this new definition. So, but what they were trying to do is think, okay, we have all these things floating around in space
mm-hmm.
And we need to be able to classify them in some useful ways. Mm-hmm. And our definition is just not working because what we're now using includes Pluto, but then we can't really distinguish it from all these other things that are flying around and stuff. Right. And they came up with a definition that allows them to really classify things more mm-hmm. meaningfully. But as a consequence, it did mean that they thought, okay, well, maybe this one thing we used to call a planet now has to be classified in a different way.
Yeah.
And
what do they call them now? Dwarf planets? Is that what it has been demoted to now?
I don't know. Something. Yeah, something else. Poor Pluto.
Yeah.
But this process is, I think, very interesting to do. Because now you're starting to think, what do you want to have a concept for? Right? What is your goal of having this concept? And what they, for example, describe is if you have a concept, one thing you do is you change the way that other people think about this thing. You can change the way that other people classify these kind of concepts, for example, by having a specific definition. And I had one idea about this because I actually wrote a paper once in 2019 on pre-registration. Mm-hmm. And I gave that like the subtitle, A Conceptual Analysis. Mm-hmm. And I did this a little bit out of frustration with my fellow meta scientists who use this word pre-registration, but yeah. They all use it so vaguely. Hmm. Everyone uses it so vaguely that you get a ton of discussion about it because everybody uses it in slightly different ways. Mm-hmm. Nobody really has a strong definition of what is this thing, you know, really with like necessary and sufficient conditions. So, for example, right, if we talk about defining a concept such as pre-registration, some people just call it sort of define it as a practice. You go onto a website, you upload a document, you describe stuff in the document, you timestamp it, and this is now a pre-registration. Now, that sounds perfectly fine. But I'm personally not really happy with treating this as a pre-registration because in my view, what the goal of a pre-registration is, it should allow other people to evaluate the severity of your test.
Right. As we have discussed previously.
As we have discussed exactly in our episode on pre-registration. Uh-huh. But reading about this idea of conceptual engineering, all of a sudden I thought, this is what I was trying to do here. Because what I'm trying to do is get people to say something. So one thing that conceptual engineering can do, it can change the truth value of language statements. Now, let me explain. So it means I'll say something, and all of a sudden, after a new conceptual definition, this statement is no longer true. So yeah. What I would like people to do mm-hmm. is say, look, you have gotten a pre-registration badge, mm-hmm. but you did not pre-register. That's a weird sentence. I want that sentence to be able to be true, mm-hmm. that you can say this. You got a pre-registration badge. Because you went through the practice, you went on the website, you got mm-hmm. the timestamp, but you did not write something that allowed others to transparently evaluate the severity of the test. Do you see? By making yeah. sort of a definition, by engineering a definition in some specific way, I can make people say, oh yeah, you actually didn't pre-register because pre-registration is this thing. Allowing people to, right? Now, whether you agree with my definition or not.
Well, not with your definition. I'm fine with your definition, actually. But there's a lot of other things I disagree with here. But finish your thought before I go into that.
Well, yeah. But anyway, this is the idea that when you are defining a concept, you're basically actively trying to achieve some sort of goal with this definition. Yeah. And that means sometimes defining it, of course, a little bit differently than other people are doing it. Then you get that's one of the approaches here. Yeah, it is criticized and you can be immediately on the side of the.
So many things I want to say. But well, first, it sort of reflects the sort of social constructivist approach that I am not sure
exactly.
I'm on board with.
You go right to the core of the debate, in of course in philosophy as well. Like, right. Is this what we want?
Yeah.
And there are definitely people who are using it for this.
Yeah.
Completely right. One of the first papers I read about this was actually very much in this direction. And I was also like, oh, well, I'm not sure if I'm completely on board with this. But then I also read some other things. Yeah. So, but you're right. This is a risk, of course, right? Now, you might not convince people of your definition if you're doing this. But yeah, yeah, of course.
The other issue is, the other main issue here is that I think that when you're doing science, mm-hmm. you have to have a realist approach to the world, right? Mm-hmm. If you're an anti-realist, that's only when you're an anti-realist can you be like, oh, but the something is only how we define it, which is what you're saying, which I think is sort of a functionalist approach. People call it mm-hmm. operationalism. Or you can be a conventionalist where you're like, oh, something is whatever mm-hmm. everybody agrees it is. Both of those mm-hmm. are anti-realist stances. And I'm, mm-hmm. I just don't think that you can do science if you, or it's not, yeah, like we need to have, there needs to be this shared understanding of, oh, there's a world out there and uh-huh. we are trying to get to it with our methods. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that your definition should be something, hey, no, I think this is what's closest at the moment that we think is to the truth that's out there independent of us. Right. So the moment you start saying that, oh, no, definitions of things depend on us, I think you run into this issue of sort of being an anti-realist. And I just don't think that's compatible with a scientific approach. The other thing, though, I will say is that there is a difference between things that exist in the world independent of us, which I think mm-hmm. should be sort of the but also things that we create. Right. I mean, the definition mm-hmm. of pre-registration doesn't just exist out there hanging on a tree. For you to observe, right? That is something that we are agreeing to call it something. So I think, I'm not sure if there's terms for this exist in philosophy or, but in, you know, like in measurement, for example, we'd make a distinction between reflective models and formative models, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think is a similar distinction of like distinguishing between responses to items that we think are being caused by something, right? We think your depression is something that causes your responses mm-hmm. on these items that are measuring depression, right? That's a reflective model, mm-hmm. right? And here we think depression is a real thing, right? It doesn't depend on me to define it. It exists out there. I'm just trying to measure it. And that is what's causing your responses on the items versus a formative model, which is like, I mean, a socioeconomic status does not exist in the world, right? It's a label mm-hmm. we've created for things. And there the arrow's going the other direction, right? We say, hey, we're going to mm-hmm. use education and income, et cetera, as indicators of this thing that doesn't mm-hmm. exist in the world, but we've just created it as a label that's useful. So it is also useful to make, I think, that distinction.
I could not agree more. Yeah. I think you summarized it perfectly. That's also what I thought when I was reading about this. And it's, of course, very interesting to think, when are the units in mm-hmm. our model very close to reality, so that I don't want to mess up scientific realism. Mm-hmm. But it's actually interesting to think where that would be, because I wanted to give an example just now, you know, happiness. Mm-hmm. Happiness, is that actually realist? Is that just a thing? Or is happiness also a bit like, yeah, but you know, happiness is also these, I don't know, you know? But I think already for pre-registration, it's definitely just a thing we made. Like, I don't know what it is exactly. And I feel there's definitely room for conceptual engineering in the field of...
Yeah, sure.
Pre-registration. And what's interesting is that there is definitely also an activist component. Because if you've made a definition that you want people to use because you think this is mm-hmm. a useful way to classify things in the world, I don't know, you just hate Pluto and you want Pluto out of the planets, you know? Yeah. But then there has to be a bit of activism behind it. Like, you have to convince people to use your definition. And I think in that process, we have the whole scientific criticism and refutation going on. So, you know, it might not make it. And that process is there. Anyway, but I really thought, okay, so this conceptualization mm-hmm. phase, super important. Super important.
Yeah, very important. I agree.
For some reason, you can't, I feel, you can't get scientists excited about really, you know, doing a process like this. Yeah. But I feel it's so useful. And we're doing it now. We're trying to go through this now. And I feel, yeah, it's very interesting. I feel that this is unexplored territory for most psychologists that we should maybe want to explore a bit more.
I agree.
Anyway,
step one.
And this, I mean, what's interesting about this is if you think about this, this is a thesis. This is somebody's thesis. If you are really a diehard, I mean, you know, certain concepts might be so big. This is a thesis, right. Basically, you know.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, one of the reasons why we don't go through all these steps that Dubin expresses, because we want to get to the theory tests. And then we actually want to do 7 of them.
Right.
And then you have a thesis.
Yeah.
But I have the feeling that if you take this very seriously, conceptualizing something, it could be somebody's thesis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's not valued, right? So why do it if people are just looking for hypothesis tests and not actually development of this conceptual work?
Yeah. I think it's not exciting. Well, I get excited about it a little bit, but I think, yeah, definitely people don't think it's exciting.
Yeah.
And also, I wouldn't even immediately know where to publish something like this. Maybe it's possible.
Psychology and theory.
Yeah. Or maybe something like psychological review or something. I mean, it could be that you have these theoretical. Anyway.
Right.
Okay. But step one, check. We have a definition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Nullius in Verba. Our theme song is Newton's Cradle by Grand Brothers. If you have any thoughts, feedback, or comments you'd like to share, you can reach us over email at nulliusinverbapod@gmail.com or our social media accounts at Mastodon or Twitter.
In this episode, we discussed the 8-step method of theory building proposed by Robert Dubin in his classic 1969 book, Theory Building. As we only got through step one of the method, we will continue discussing the remaining 8 steps in the next episode. We hope you will join us.